Do you want to be part of a wellness revolution in 2022? This year, prioritize your first with Beams Premium CBD products for sleep. I can't not tell you how often I've had a struggle with sleeping. I've talked about it on this podcast, and I've tried everything from melatonin to Benadryl to you name it. And here's why I love Beam. Beam's nano CBD dramatically increases your body's ability to absorb CBD, making their products the most effective in the wellness space. All you have to do is mix their dream powder into your hot water or milk, stir it, and enjoy it before bedtime. I did it recently, and I gotta tell you, the dream powder lives up to the name. I slept like a baby, and I haven't slept that well in a long, long time. For a limited time, get $20 off of $75 or more when you go to beamorganics.com/scale and use code scale at checkout. That's beamorganics.com/scale and use code scale for $20 off. Make 2022 the year of you.
Welcome back to another episode of the Uncharted Podcast. Really excited to have today's guest on the show, Bardia Shahali, VP of Sales at Teleport. Thanks for joining us today, Bardia.
Thanks for having me, Robbie.
We always like to start with kind of your founding story. Tell us about your childhood, where you grew up, any siblings, and what your parents did for a living.
I'm an immigrant. I was born in Tehran, Iran, and lived there until I was 9 years old before we moved to Canada. Growing up in Iran was a very interesting experience. I don't know how much you know about the relations between the United States and Iran, but let's just say they're not super friendly, right? So growing up there, it was just interesting because there was a ton of anti-American sentiment on TV. Like American TV was not legal. You could not watch it. You could not, you know, wear shirts that had English writing on it. So it was just kind of a weird environment to grow up in. And you know, when you prohibit something, naturally it becomes much more interesting. So we had illegal satellite in my house. So I was watching MTV all the time. And we had a guy who was a VHS dealer who would literally come to our house with a suitcase of VHSs. And he'd be like slinging Lion King and The Mask by Jim Carrey. So I grew up watching a ton of American content and fell in love with it. When we moved to Canada, I really wanted to go to film school. And that was one of the reasons, because I grew up watching so much American content. So I ended up actually going to film school before getting into tech sales and making movies and things like that. So it was a really interesting experience.
Wow. So the other person on this call who was born in Tehran is Poya. Poya, like, I'll bounce what Bardia just said about his experience growing up there off you. Like, similar journey, similar experience growing up.
Very, very accurate. Yeah. It's although the governments are against each other, the people for the most part admire one another, especially once they get to know each other. Like, I've actually had a couple of friends, like one of my best friends from college, that traveled to Tehran like a few years ago, and he went like to Tabriz and the surrounding areas, and he's like, oh, the people, like, so nice, so kindful. So like, that's the sentiment across the board. But obviously, for a wide variety of reasons, as well as the history, the two governments don't get along. I'm actually really, really curious to get your perspective. How was it telling your parents that you're going into tech sales versus becoming a lawyer or a doctor or something?
Yeah, clearly you're Persian. Because there's only three things you could do to make your parents proud if you're Iranian. It's like doctor, engineer, lawyer. My mom still asked me like if like I'm thinking about going to law school, and I'm like, Mom, I'm 35, it's over, like, move on, it's not happening. But yeah, I mean, the funny thing is, my dad was, I didn't know it at the time, but my dad was also a VP of sales at a software company growing up. I was just like too young to know what he was doing, but as I grew up and I started flipping through pictures of him in the past, I see him at like conferences standing next to a booth. It was really funny. I was like, okay, it was meant to be.
I'm gonna say, dad grinding the booth, like, apple doesn't fall too far from the tree is what I'm hearing you say.
Oh yeah. And the booth looks so old school. Like, if you see the graphics on this thing, it's like Pentium 2. The computer, it's like one of those like yellowish, like looking monitors, like the plastic is all yellow. Yeah, it's pretty funny.
But you didn't know that your dad was in that line of business until later in life, it sounds like.
Yeah, until I was like in my 20s. I just remember him always being on calls, like talking super intensely. He had a pretty intense way of communicating. So, you know, we would walk by his office and he'd just be like yelling, dropping F-bombs. So like, what is this guy doing in this room? But he was selling software. So, you know, he's doing his job.
That's pretty funny. I wonder if I just had a, we have a 1-year-old kid, and I wonder if that's exactly what he's going to think about me in the way that I work, just shouting in the phone and a little bit confused about exactly what's going on all day. So let's fast forward a bit. You go to film school. Tell me about how that just like has influenced your worldview, like totally different a path than maybe somebody would expect for like a VP of sales who's running like a large SaaS organization to take. Like what did you take from that experience and how do you like bring that with you in the way that you see the world today?
For sure. I mean, I think one of the biggest parts of success or being successful in sales is your ability to capture an audience and tell stories. So going through that experience of making short films and then being an assistant in Hollywood. So I actually got an internship in Hollywood. That's how I came out to LA. And I was working at one of those agencies. I don't know if you've ever seen the show Entourage, but I was pretty much Lloyd in Entourage. I was an assistant to this like crazy agent. So I did that for a couple of years. And that's a kind of a blend of sales and storytelling because the agents in Hollywood are salespeople, right? All they're doing is pitching actors to casting directors, pitching writers to casting directors or production companies. And through that experience, you get exposed to that. You learn a couple of tricks. And then you also read a lot of scripts. Like I remember when I was working in Hollywood, and not to age myself too much here, but at the time, Tarantino's unscripted or untitled project was kind of like flowing through the agencies. And that was actually Inglourious Basterds. So I got to read that way before it came out. You know, I think the storytelling bit definitely is helpful, you know, pitching ideas. And then finally, the agents are ultimately salespeople. So it's not that much different.
It's all storytelling. So it's I couldn't agree more. I went to Chapman, where it's like actually a very popular film school and lots of people go. And next thing you know, you get over the film industry. It takes it out on you. It's not for everybody. They move over and then they move over to usually sales, usually ad sales is what I've seen, but they kill it because of the storytelling and as well as the network aspect of it. So you go to Terangelis, right? You have some success there, work your way into software. I'm actually going to fast forward some of your career because I'm actually really interested about your most recent journey as a VP of sales. Sure. And you've like the average VP of sales usually lasts, I don't know, somewhere between, frankly, 9 months to a year and a half, usually is what I've seen, right? I'm curious, why in your case have you had the success you've had of being at Teleport now for almost 40 months, right? Like what do you think are some of the reasons you've lasted as long as you have compared to your peers?
Yeah, I mean, I would love to say that it's just because of my skills and how good I am at my job, but let's be honest, right? That's not the case. I think it's a combination of things. One is picking your startup wisely, and we can kind of get into that. Like, how do you pick a company where it sets you up for success or increases your chances of succeeding? And the second thing is, I think you just have to be able to adapt as the company grows. And if you're not good at adapting, then the company outgrows you, right? So for example, when I joined, sure, my title was head of sales, but let's be honest, I was the first sales hire, right? I was employee number 12 or 13. There was no one to manage. So all I was doing was closing deals, building traction, figuring out how things worked. And then you have to adapt, right? Now you're bringing in SDRs. Now you're hiring sales engineers and customer success. And now you're hiring reps. And how do you adapt and not micromanage them to your style, let them kind of do their thing? And you know, most recently, I've actually helped us recruit our CRO who's starting soon, right? And that's really interesting because, you know, I've heard of this before where people are like, oh, you know, it's only a matter of time before you get, replaced by a CRO. And there's two ways to think about that. One is the reason they're bringing in the CRO is because we've done a really good job of building that traction and we're kind of getting ready for the next phase of the company. Or you can take the mindset of, oh, how dare they try to replace me? And you could try to fight it. And if you don't adapt, again, you get pushed out, right? So I think if you're strategic about adapting and making the most out of the opportunity, you can have a long runway at a company that you join early.
Yeah, that resonates a lot, especially the perspective on what it means to be like topped. I've heard this conversation going along on different corners of the, you know, of the community and of the internet. And I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I remember early in my career when I was at a unicorn company running a team and got topped and I thrashed a little bit. I took it a little bit personally and I was young. I didn't understand that I had a lot to learn and, you know, could probably just lean in a bit more and just be excited about what it meant for me and the team and everything. I've tried to learn that lesson and take it with me that actually can be a really positive thing. So let's talk a little bit about what you look for. Like when you think about going back to where you were at the time you took the role at Teleport, like walk us through your framework for breaking down like the real startup opportunities to bet on from the fake.
Yeah, for sure. I think there's a couple of things, right? And there's a couple of traps to avoid. So maybe let's talk about the traps, because I think that a lot of people are falling into these traps. And I just want to make sure if you're listening to this podcast, you can avoid this. But one of the things that I've heard is, you know, people try to join startups with founders that have had a lot of past success. And they're like, oh, you know, these founders have had a lot of success in the past. This one's going to be a winner too. And that's not always the case. So if you just like focus on that, a lot of times what I've actually seen is, you know, success can make people sometimes kind of soft, and maybe they're not as hungry to kill it in their next startup. So if you're joining a founder who's already made $1 billion and you're joining his second thing just based on his name, that's actually a pretty dangerous strategy, because what could happen is he can get a lot of, or he or she can get a lot of traction in the early days just based on his or her name. But guess what? It's going to fizzle out, right? So that's one thing that I've seen happen to multiple people and something that I look for. I'm not going to say like I wouldn't join a startup with a founder who's had past success, but I wouldn't solely focus on that. That would be kind of a dangerous thing. The next thing is just trends. So for me, I was, I was at Intercom at first, and Intercom is kind of like a MarTech company. You know, they sell support, and you got to look around and see what companies are killing it, right? So you look at the public markets, and if you were at Intercom, you have Zendesk, you have Salesforce, you have HubSpot. But then you look at some other verticals like cybersecurity and infrastructure engineering, and then you have Datadog, you know, CrowdStrike, Zscaler, Cloudflare. The names just keep going on and on. So I think positioning yourself in the right sector that's poised for natural growth is also like a good strategy. Ideally, you like the sector. And for me, I like technical products. I like dev first type things and security. So Teleport, again, check the boxes on a lot of those. Another trend that was interesting to me was kind of the explosion of commercializing open source software. So you see the power of that now with companies like HashiCorp and Confluent and GitLab, Elastic, and Teleport, again, fit the bill on that. And then the last two things, one is the founders. It's like, you got to just feel good about your discussion with the founders, right? If you walk away and you have doubts after speaking with the founders, I would say just move on, because you got to feel like they're going to have your back. Especially when things get tough. And I really felt that with the founders. For me, it's really important to work with technical founders. Again, I'll probably miss some opportunities by not working with founders who are like sales focused, but my preference is always going to be founders who are super, super technical. So I can complement what they bring to the table with my kind of sales contributions. And the final thing was early traction. I mean, when I joined Teleport, it was super, super early, but they had already landed like a couple of really impressive logos. NASDAQ was a customer, Samsung was a customer. And I was like, okay, these guys have been able to land these deals with no sales. If you kind of supercharge that with a proper sales motion, things could really take off. And the bet paid off, right? So that's kind of the framework that I used.
So I'm just going to chime in here just for the listeners to give them some context. The biggest learning I'm frankly getting from your experience is I am sure you've had to go through some learning to find out what you want and what you don't want. So
of course,
for everyone listening, right? Like what works for you doesn't work for others. But the underlying thing that's really important is you've had to go through some of those pain points, right? And find out what you want and what you don't want. And what's really important is to take a step back every quarter, every 6 months and reflect, right? And find out why you want something, maybe why you don't want something. And the biggest killer, in my opinion, are world now is we compare each other like way too much, right? Like maybe I'm a consultant and I see one of you guys kill it in a full-time opportunity or vice versa. Like we always think the grass is greener, but it's not. So that kudos to you. What I'm basically trying to say is like, I think it's really, really important to take a step back, have a framework about your own assessments and what ticks you and what you want in your opportunity. And obviously the deal breaker is like making sure that like you double down on those. The second part of the conversation where I'm really excited to take is, as it pertains to hiring, I have never seen a more hot market for people in terms of like recruiting. Like every other day, someone like the shelf life, especially for revenue roles, whether you're in marketing or sales or SDR, is just like too thin. And there's just on both sides of the equation. On the candidate side, I think there's a lot of great companies out there looking to hire, and vice versa. There's a, just in our space, right? There's just much, much more talented folks compared to like even a 5 to 10 years ago. How have you gone about recruiting, and what are some of the lessons you've learned over like the last 3 years, right? Like what are, like, talk to us a little bit about like some of the tactical things that if someone's like, I don't know, maybe building their first team, that you really wish you knew, as you were getting things going at Teleport.
Yeah. So, you know, some of this may be more specific to what I had to deal with when I started, but you know, when I started at Teleport, back then it was called Gravitational. It was a seed stage company. No one knew who we were. The talent market was still pretty hot 3 years ago, not as hot as now, but you don't really have the luxury of landing like A plus talent, right? Because there's so many options there. So one of the things that I did early on was focus purely on just aptitude. So I hired a couple people straight out of college. Both of them ended up killing it, by the way, and they got promoted and now they're, you know, doing other roles at the company. But those first couple of hires are really important because they help you build momentum and they tell their friends about you. So, you know, I would be very, very strict about the first couple of hires you're going to make. Don't make any compromises because A, if they don't work out, it's going to suck. You're going to have to start from scratch. And B, if they really work out, now you get to tap into their networks. So I got to do that with you know, Andy Taylor, who's at the company. He was an SDR, went out to be an AE, brought over his friends. You know, James Murphy joined me too from Palo Alto Networks. He ended up bringing one of our best reps, one of our best sales engineers. They ended up bringing their friends. So I think if you make the first couple of really, really high quality hires, and obviously you want to always make high quality hires, but those first couple ones I think are critical because they'll bring their friends and it'll just help you build so much momentum in the early days. Another thing is promoting internally. I know a lot of people talk about that, but I don't know. I've hired a ton of SDRs who've gotten promoted to AEs and they're killing it. So again, I think sometimes people tend to over-index on experience. They're like, oh, well, this person doesn't have any closing experience. This person doesn't have any management experience. And I think if you take chances on people and really take a chance based on their aptitude and work with them for 3 to 6 months, you'll be surprised to how far you can take them. So that's worked for me really well.
Yeah, that's awesome. I want to double down on what you said about the referrals, like generating referrals from folks that have joined the team. And like, if you can hire two reps well and make them successful, you should really index on them tapping into their network and like bringing the next two people in. In fact, the first 10 AEs I hired in a similar VP of sales, like, you know, seed stage role, were literally all referrals, every single one of them. And I think you have to be a little bit careful because it can get homogenous. Like people tend to hang out with people that look and feel and say,
them.
So you have to be like, you have to have some, like, you know, if diversity and inclusion is like a, you know, priority in your hiring process, you have to like be conscious about like inserting that in different ways if you're going for a referral strategy. But to your point, you can get access to talent you probably otherwise wouldn't get at that stage by tapping into those early people's network. That's a really good point. I'd like to double down or ask a question on the SDR promotion piece. Like, advice for sales leaders who have SDR functions and have like big AE headcounts over their head. How did you think about like when it was the right time to level up those SDRs and like building a program that was like setting them up for success? So they weren't stepping into overly complex deals that were going to be, you know, too big to fail type of thing. How did you make that program work?
Yeah, I mean, in the beginning, it was around, just out of necessity, like we just needed the help, right? So like I was a little bit more aggressive with promoting internally from SDR to AE. Now there's a little bit more process around it. So, you know, if an SDR is like really blowing out their number for 9 months, 6 to 9 months, typically, we'll start to have that conversation and find a path for them to move into an AE role. And then the AEs at our company also have different quotas based on their level within the company. So, we don't throw them in the deep end with like a super, super high quota right off the bat. We also give them a ramp. You know, I've seen crazy things at companies where, you know, they promote someone from one function to another and don't give them a ramp whatsoever because they're like, oh, you've already been at the company, so you should just be able to hit the ground running. I mean, little things like that actually matter. Like, I think you should give them a ramp to just give them a chance to get that confidence, right? Get those wins. So that's kind of the process that we've taken. Another point I wanted to make earlier around like driving referrals for salespeople, Robbie, obviously you know this, but it's like salespeople want to get paid, especially in the early days. Like if a salesperson is taking a chance to join your startup, give them an aggressive comp plan, right? And this is a conversation that I had with our founders and they came around, they were cool with it. But you want those first 2-3 AEs to really blow it out of the water, because the extra commission that you're paying them will actually end up being cost savings for you on the recruiting side, because they're going to go get referrals. And I think a lot of people don't think about that way. They're like, oh, well, the AEs are making too much money. Like we should cap their commissions, or they start talking about crazy ideas like that. So I don't know. I think that's just another important pointer that I've picked up.
I couldn't agree more. Like, and even like said differently, but making the same point, you de-risk the interview process if the AE candidates who are going through the process are talking to AE peers that are above 100% of goal and are extremely happy about the money that they're making and are telling real stories about how they're performing. Like that just reinforces the program you're building and gets the reputation going. Listen, Bardia, this has been so fun. I could riff with you about your approach to building sales organizations all day. Love the feedback and guidance on how to think about the talent market right now and how to pick the right startup for you and the framework and lens that you looked through. I think like obviously that firsthand experience matters, but that's really good actionable advice for the group. And how funny that you and Poya, born and raised, I shouldn't say necessarily raised for too long, but for part of your lives in Tehran, that's awesome. One final question we always like to ask our guests, would love to ask you, if you were to go back in time, maybe to film school, talk to 18-year-old Bardia in the Lloyd role, maybe after that you described, what's one piece of advice you'd give to yourself at a younger age?
I would say, you know, when I was younger and you're always comparing yourself to other people, right? You're like, wow, this person's killing it. Or, you know, this person's building a business. This person's making so much money. One of the bad habits I used to have was I used to chalk up a lot of that stuff and be like, oh, well, this person must have been lucky, or it was mostly luck, right? And that's a really bad way to think about other people's success because it's not really actionable. So I guess if I were to go back in time, I would say just assume that everyone who's successful has earned every bit of success, because even if it's not true, at least it forces you to try to dig into what they're doing and learn. Because if you just chalk up things to luck, there's nothing to explore and learn, right? It's just kind of like, okay, it's just luck.
Yeah, it's the end of the story at that point. That's really well said. Well, Bardia, thanks for joining us. Super fun. Always appreciate the advice. For the listeners who are still on, follow Bardia on LinkedIn. He's consistently posting like really solid content about the journey. He's on today at Teleport. And I personally love the content you're putting out there and the advice and feedback that you give to the community. So keep doing it. And thanks again for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Robbie. Thanks, Bardia. Talk soon.
Do you want to be part of a wellness revolution in 2022? This year, prioritize your first with Beams Premium CBD products for sleep. I can't not tell you how often I've had a struggle with sleeping. I've talked about it on this podcast, and I've tried everything from melatonin to Benadryl to you name it. And here's why I love Beam. Beam's nano CBD dramatically increases your body's ability to absorb CBD, making their products the most effective in the wellness space. All you have to do is mix their dream powder into your hot water or milk, stir it, and enjoy it before bedtime. I did it recently, and I gotta tell you, their dream powder lives up to the name. I slept like a baby, and I haven't slept that well in a long, long time. For a limited time, get $20 off of $75 or more when you go to beamorganics.com/scale and use code scale at checkout. That's beamorganics.com/scale and use code scale for $20 off. Make 2022 the year of you.